Hello, you're listening to Death by Adaptation. I'm not Niccolo Grasso, I'm Ewan Glero, his guest often on this podcast. Niccolo has joined me, but I will be leading this very experimental episode of the podcast. I hope you're doing well, hope you're having a wonderful day, probably better than mine. Spilled coffee down myself this morning, almost fell up the stairs, and I imagine I've severed some ligaments in my wrist carrying my big desk upstairs, which for audio, it's no good, but video, you can see big boxes behind me. It's like I live in an Amazon warehouse at the moment.
Yes.
But Nick, how are you? Hopefully better than desk land over here.
I'm doing well. I have a bit of sore muscles because went to the gym yesterday and did way more than I should have, and then I had a whole day of like shooting in the museum that I work at. So it was lots of carrying equipment around, but I'm excited. I'm happy. It's fun to be on the other side for once. It's like, oh man, it's weird. I'm experiencing this. Like, I don't know where this is going. I don't know where we're going to end up here. It's going to be a magical and mystical place.
That's the thing. It is worrying, isn't it? Not only because this is the first time I've ever hosted a podcast, but also because this episode's a bit of a tangent, isn't it? It's a bit explorative. It's a bit unique in that we're actually looking at the work of a musician and a film alongside it. The book is a collection of lyrics from Pulp Frontman and General Music Man Jarvis Cocker. And the film we're looking at is Pulp, a film about life, death, and supermarkets, a documentary from Florian Habich. Not a clue, but he is a grand documentary filmmaker who has directed essentially a film about the reunion of Pulp, which was led by the man's book, Jarvis Cocker, who wrote quite a few songs in his time, still does. He wrote for the likes of Marianne Faithfull, Nancy Sinatra, as well as producing his own records. And such a lengthy career isn't being documented that much, surprisingly, in documentaries, which I'm sure we'll get into because
yes.
Do you guys want to be a movie?
Yes, please.
Say that again. Do you want
to
be in a movie?
Oh my God! What's the movie about?
It took us a long time to get here.
It's what's going on in your head that really counts.
Stage, and we'll be thinking, oh, this is the center of the universe here. But, you know, there'll be people doing all sorts of things. Some people will be watching the telly, some people will be going and scoring some drugs, somebody will probably be giving birth. All these parallel stories are all going on.
It makes you think, what they say, and I like music that makes you think.
Sculpture at St. Martin's College.
As ever, Nick, I have prepared notes and questions, as ever.
You know this will be serious when the questions and notes are involved.
And I suppose I'll open with the most important one, is that I remember when I sprung this on you, I don't think you really knew what Pulp was or who Jarvis Cocker was.
It was like, is this something you eat? What is a Jarvis Cocker? Is this a Star Wars character?
I remember he sounds like a Star Wars character.
He really does.
Oh, God. It's brand new from George Lucas, the exclusive Mattel Jarvis Cocker range. But what did you have any experience at all with Pulp or their songs or Jarvis Cocker before I set you off on a history-finding expedition?
I wasn't aware of them, but when you just shared the name, I was like, let me just look it up.
Yeah.
And of course, as you might well expect, I was like, oh, Common People, I've heard of that song.
That song from Jackass 3.5, the end credits bit.
There you go.
Classic.
The classic movie is streaming on Netflix now worldwide. But yes, no, it's, I did hear it there. I know it is an anthem that's been going on around the world for, I want to say, 20 years. He wrote it like at the end of the late 80s. So I was familiar about that. And then I looked at Jarvis Cocker himself. I was like, oh, wait. He did some Wes Anderson things.
He did.
Popped up here and then.
He's got his fingers in a lot of pies, this lad. He was Tip Top from The French Dispatch. The famous singer that wore Timothy Chalamet. Is quite the fan of, and he did a cover of a fantastic French track called Aline, which I think is an incredible song, and just hearing his voice, because I think I've been a fan of Jarvis Cocker for quite a while, and I've recently done another podcast which was video, and someone essentially pointed out that I wore a blazer to that, and I wasn't even thinking, but apparently I looked like Jarvis Cocker had he grown up in the further north of England and put on a lot of weight.
But I can see that, honestly, you know.
It's the glasses, isn't it?
It is the glasses.
The big frame. It's almost as if that's an intentional fashion choice.
Oh, man.
Because, man, that guy's a huge influence, not just on my aesthetic and my fashion, but also on just my career so far. It was when I started at uni, I started listening to Pulp, and it's the reason I've got records, it's the reason I've done a lot of things. And I suppose it's like an exorcism this month that I've had to go through this lyric book, this wonderful lyric book that has hopefully, Nick, opened you up a bit to what he's done.
We'll see.
We will, because I wanted to ask you quickly about the introduction, the little essay at the start of it.
Loved it. So basically, Mother, Brother, Lover opens up with Jarvis Cocker just basically kind of saying, you know, I don't write lyrics because I want to. I write them because I have to. Please, if you're reading this book, just don't listen to the songs during it, which is literally what I asked you. When I picked up a book, I was like, wait a second, Dion, should I listen to the songs beforehand, like during it? It's literally like the second or third page of the introduction, which, let me actually read it up. Wait.
Yeah.
Find it. Come on, book.
Come on, book. Oh, I hate it when my book doesn't load.
Because it's all digital.
It's all digital these days. It's all bloody, what you call it? What's technology made of? Fiberglass.
Bitrate? Oh, fiberglass, yeah.
Fiberglass and bitrate, yeah.
So basically, he says, like, this kind of friction between, because he's talking about, like, the issues, which is very interesting and fascinating, because I want to say that up until a uni, actually, yes, like 6 years ago, more or less, I didn't really care that much about lyrics, but for some reason, circa like 2016, 2017, I started to get into, like, hey, they're kind of saying something in the words. Let me just focus on that a little bit, when, like, listening to songs by anyone. And so it's fascinating to read him say, basically, you know, just I don't really put that much effort into them. It's very separate for him writing the lyrics and writing the music. And so he says, this kind of friction between the words and the music presents problems for me when displaying the lyrics in isolation. Ever since lyric sheets started to be included in my record releases, I have included the instructions NB. Please do not read the lyrics whilst listening to the recordings. This is because the words only exist to be part of something else, a song. And when you see them on a printed page, you're seeing them taken out of their natural habitat, away from that something else. And with this, it changed my thinking going into it. I refused to listen to any of their songs before being done with this lyrics book. And it was worth it.
Yeah.
This, to me, this is not a lyrics book. This is a collection of poems.
I'm so glad you said that.
I'm so curious to know your thoughts. You'd read this before, right?
No, I hadn't. But I'd listened to all the songs in this book before I'd gone to it, because I'm that big of a fan. So for me, it was because I essentially, my playlist for like the gym and my favorites playlist is essentially 80% Pulp, 10% Jarvis Cocker, and like 5% Leonard Cohen, and the other 5% Yardak now. So going through this, I'd especially Common People in Disco 2000, which were essentially like every Friday when I went to a nightclub, they would be on. It was kind of reading through this, was you could see the hooks where the commas were, where the full stops were. You could imagine the pauses in the lyrics. And it was bringing it to life on the page. Mm-hmm. And it added still a new layer to the song, because it was... It's now that I can go back and read the lyrics, and it's kind of not just for these lyrics, but any lyric. It's after you've listened to it, you can go back and see that's why that's there. This is why there's a hook here. That's where the verse bleeds into the chorus, and it's hard to do that with every song. Mm-hmm. But there are some great songs, and I always think of stuff like Bob Dylan or Leonard Cohen. That's like you read their lyrics, because they can be read as lyrics. They can be read as the written word. Not every musician can manage this, you know, lyric as both song and as poetry. And I think just going through Mother, Brother, Lover, which is just a beautiful Rule of Three. Fantastic. Can't get over Mother, Brother, Lover.
He loved those.
I love stuff like that. That's what 6 years of studying English does to you. But from just going through it, especially the history of the... It's essentially a history book. It is a collection of lyrics from a long, long career put to poetry. And I may as well just break the big question. What was your favourite from this book? That's panicked, yeah. That's good. That's always a good start.
Because like, there's many. I didn't. Yeah. I kind of regret not because when I was reading it, I didn't bookmark any of the pages, and so I kind of went quickly through it, kind of like, oh, this song and this song.
Oh yeah, I panicked last night and thought, I've got a podcast tomorrow. I better write down, because there's a lot of lyrics that are quite historical in here. You've got Mile End, which was from the Trainspotting soundtrack. You've got
little bits and
pieces that weren't even released as album pieces. That are just kind of shunted in here. It's a real odd collection. Probably from my point of view of being a fan, there are lyrics in here for songs that just haven't released. There are lyrics in here that just aren't from very particularly good songs, like The Trees, which is just...
There are some
really
weird ones, yeah.
Yeah, and it's all just strangely put together in a nice way.
I was struggling because like I went through it quickly and I was struggling to find it, but there was one song where I knew I was reading something brilliant. I want to say it's halfway through the book, which is halfway through his career, pretty much, I imagine.
Oh, pretty much, yeah.
Which is way after Common People, where it's this examination of fame and how it might have gotten to his head, and it's kind of like, well, you've talked about Common People, but you've kind of distanced yourself from them. It was something like that. I don't remember the exact...
Cocaine Socialism.
That's so the one. Yes.
Cocaine Socialism's fantastic. So that was a demo. It's not being released on vinyl or anything. And it was turned into a song called Glory Days.
Okay.
Where essentially it was just minor changes, tweaking the lyrics, but it's more or less the same instinct to it.
Fascinating.
Beautiful song.
Yeah, and that's where I really connected to it, because you are, like, so many of those songs are written in first person.
Yeah.
And you're always kind of wondering, who is he talking about? He's talking about himself. Now, a more fictionalized version of himself, of course, but there is so much of him in the lyrics that comes naturally. And that's also, like, you know, it's kind of explained in the introduction as well, where he says pretty much, like... I talk about what I know, talk about my life. That's what I know. So that's what I'm going to be writing this book. But there are some fun ones. There was this one that was very, very short. I don't even know if it's an actual song, but like Disney Time.
Yes, that's
an actual
first
song,
solo album. Yeah,
where they talk about adult movies, and it's how come they're called adult movies when the only thing they show is people making babies filmed up close. I'm feeling so much better since I learned to avert my eyes. Now it's Disney Time.
So I mean, I assume you've seen the theme of a lot of his lyrics, which is essentially sex and the relationship between someone and the actual act itself, rather than the people in it.
Yes.
A lot of them, especially babies, where he's hiding in the wardrobe instead of actually being a part of the act. There's another song as well. I don't know if it's actually in this one. I'm trying to find it. This is Hardcore.
I want to say it is in here. But
I
like
think it is. Yeah, it was a pretty big song.
After watching the documentary and like a few other videos, even the ones that you sent me, like the song itself and various remixes, it feels like something that's in here. This is Hardcore. I found it.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I've seen all the pictures. I've studied them forever. I want to make a movie, so let's star in it together. It's talking about the act of it rather than it itself, which is phenomenally difficult to write, because I can't think of many lyricists, if any, that can actually write about sex in a convincing way, not just with music, but with books as well. I remember reading the Joe Abercrombie fantasy novels. What were they called? The Last King, something Kingdom or something. I can't remember what you call them, because I hated them. And one of the big issues I had with it was just it didn't feel convincing in its characters and its dynamics and its situations, where even though it's fantasy, the reality of human relationships needs to be accurate. It needs to be fulfilling it to some extent. Or if it's not fulfilling, it needs to be explained why. And I think that's why I like Cocker's work quite a lot, is that he's explaining why things don't work in the real world and why music can sort of twist the arm a little bit. And it's just really just a rewarding experience.
Yeah. And I honestly was surprised. He's a massive horn dog. That's not something I was expecting going into this. Like, there is a lot of sex in here. But it's also like the implications of it. There's so many songs about, you know, regret of certain relationships.
Yeah.
I want to say there are some songs that also like tackle the fact of having children, unwanted pregnancies, and like all of those repercussions and like wanting to be in a physical relationship when you're not ready for an emotional one, and how the two kind of bleed with one another. Like you said, it's very mature. It's very hard hitting, but also still very fun. Like, there's even the most serious songs in here managed to crack a smile on my face.
It's such a frustratingly good blend. And you can kind of chart his career through the lyrics. You look at something kind of like very early on, something like Little Girl with Blue Eyes, which is, it has the obvious sexual line, so much so that when it first released, the radio shows would refuse to play it. Even like the 1 a.m. shows were saying, we're not playing that filth.
Is this the one with the hole between your legs?
Yes, yeah.
that's the lyrics that stay in your
such a great
mind.
Line. But you chart it from the early days of that sort of sexually repressed area to something like I Never Said I Was Deep, which is essentially a song about being in love with the idea of someone rather than the person themselves. And it's such a maturity, but at the same time doesn't lose its kind of seedy edge. And it's kind of exploded a bit in the This Is Hardcore era of Pulp, which is possibly my favourite album of theirs. I'm not too sure. But I do love the cover, which caused quite a bit of controversy at the time. It had posters in the London Underground. A lot of people spray-painted on it, saying this is demeaning, this is derogatory. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that. What do you think? It's kind of the explosion of over-sexualisation there. The lyrics are quite sexualised, but then apart from This Is Hardcore, there's not really anything on the album, covers or anything about the music other than the lyrics that is really that sexualized.
Well, it's interesting because it came out, like I was wondering, when did it come out? It came out in March 98.
Which is, what was around at that time? I was yet to be born.
I was less than a year old that came out. So I don't really remember, you know, living in Italy. I didn't see it on the news. I don't think a single person knows about Pulp in Italy. I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't even come here for a concert.
It's surprising. So they did a reunion tour and they actually went to Italy for like two
did
gigs.
They?
Yeah.
Or maybe like
really
Milan.
Cult gigs. Yeah.
Yeah. Milan and Rome, they tend to get those names.
Pretty much, yeah.
I'm not against. I've always been very open about, you know, sexualization and very, like, you know, erotic, more strong, sexually charged images. I don't think, like, I think it's as someone who was growing up. I started this in a very weird way. It's like everyone grew up in some ways. Let me rephrase it.
You're still growing up if you think
I'm
about
still
it.
Growing up in some way, you know, not the good ways. But as a child, I would never be traumatized seeing, you know, like kinky DVD covers or album covers in the shop. I would be traumatized by horror covers and things like that. So, or like, you know, violent images. It was like, I guess the severed fingers of Saw 2 are allowed on a poster on like massive billboards around.
Oh, God,
like, I think that's more troubling than, you know, a lady lying down and you just see side breasts.
Well, that's the thing, yeah.
Especially from 98, I would say, like, after punk, after the 80s, after everything.
Yeah,
is it just a regression of sorts? Like, this is too much now.
At the time, This Is Hardcore release, it was essentially the end of the Britpop era. It essentially crashed and burned after Be Here Now, which was Oasis's third album. And there was a real mad scarpa for a lot of the big bands at the time, like Blur, like Oasis. Well, apart from Oasis wanted to keep the party of Britpop going. Everybody else had just kind of receded in on themselves and thought, we need to make a record so totally removed from the aesthetic that had been attributed to it at the time, which was the common people, Wonderwall sort of variety of song, the very upbeat, poppy, oh, aren't we fun to be British type of music that Pulp kind of distanced itself from, but also adapted the sound of. It's very much Europop meets Electric Light Orchestra with working class lyrics. But This Is Hardcore felt like an active deconstruction of that period, and I feel like that's why it's a bit darker, a bit more seedy than what their albums would usually be, especially the song Party Hard, which is just I'll get the lyric because it's just a phenomenal. I think there's going to be a lot of this podcast is going to be, oh, I'll get the lyric, hang on,
it's just looking for lyrics and reading them up.
I wrote it down on my computer, never mind. Where is it? There it is.
Page 65 on mine.
Page 84 on mine.
Smaller cat.
I was having a whale of a time until your uncle's psychosis arrived. Why do we have to half kill ourselves just to prove we're alive? And it's like, that's very different to something like Feeling Called Love, which is like, and considering like the span between finishing the Different Class tour to starting This Is Hardcore is about half a year. It did not take long for the mood to shift. And I think that's what Cocker's lyrics throughout this has been quite good at, is capturing the mood of the times. I think if you read something like The Trees or Bad Cover Version, even if I'm not particularly keen on the former, it's very environmentally charged at a time when Tea in the Park was happening, when environmentally conscious festivals were occurring. And then The Last Day of the Miners Strike's a bit of a strange one, which is about the 80s and Margaret Thatcher's...
kind of went back in a way.
It did, yeah, because I think they wrote that years before it was released. It was essentially to get out of recording another album. They did a hits edition, and they threw that on at the end, even though it had never been released. But, you know, Pulp was a strange beast. It had been around since the 70s, and then it ended rather dramatically so. Well, it, actually, quite the opposite. Quietly. Very quietly ended in 2001. And as Cocker says in the documentary, it felt like unfinished business, that there was something left over. And I guess that kind of brings us nicely onto the documentary, because ironically, for a documentary trying to close the chapter of Pulp, it feels like it leaves a lot open. So you pretty much went into this, you've no idea who this gangly working class man is that Ewan tries to look like. What did you think of a film about life, death, and supermarkets?
Okay. I'll just say this. I looked at the poster for the movie, and the poster is two elderly ladies. One of them has a massive grin.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, this is going to be like a Dirty Grandpa situation. Like, they're going to be dressed up as old people and probably like go around supermarkets, and then there's going to be a bit of a concert. I don't know. I was like, because I didn't know how it was going to be like. I was like, I don't know what Jarvis Cocker looks like. I've seen him, but like, I don't know. It's like, could be, you know, it could be something quirky. It wasn't. Spoilers, it wasn't quirky in that sense, at least.
Quirky in the wrong way.
in an unexpected way. I was surprised by this documentary. I think it is overall a bit flawed. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a great film, but it has greatness in it.
Yeah. And
weirdly enough, my favorite parts of the documentary are not with the band.
Ooh.
Because just to introduce the documentary a little bit, like you mentioned, like they had a revival concert tour that they had in the late 2010s, early 2010s.
That's 10 years ago now, a whole 10 decade. 10
years ago, yes.
That's mad.
And they went back to their hometown of Sheffield for the final concert of Pulp ever in history of ever. Maybe we'll see.
Well, you never know, Nick, but about 2 weeks later, they appeared on the Jonathan Ross show, and they did one song.
Well,
so technically, their last appearance was on BBC Two or ITV or whatever Jonathan Ross is on these days. So
technically, they're liars.
Technically, yes. Those Coachella Festival ones didn't help either. Technically, they've hoodwinked us. I think it was like their last concert.
Their last proper concert. Their
last proper tour. Yeah.
And so they went back to their hometown, and the documentary follows the Pulp band members as they're setting up the final concert. And it keeps cutting back and forth between them and the actual concert itself as it's being prepared, so just to keep it a bit more engaging, you know. But it also shows the common people of Sheffield, like the real hardworking individuals, like elderly ladies, young kids, singers and workers, and just the people of Sheffield.
Bit of everyone, isn't it? Yeah.
Bit of everyone. And that's what I really connected with. Because it could have been so, so easy to make just a classic, you know, it's one last hurrah for pulp.
Yes.
2 hours or 90 minutes of just self-congratulatory, you know, we did it, boys. This is the end of the line. It's like, no, no, no. They always cared so much about the little people. Well, little people sounds bad. They care so much about, you know, the people of their hometown, and that's where
the everyday people, yeah.
The everyday people, and they've made socially conscious songs and environmentally conscious, you mentioned as well. That's why I like that you're actually seeing the impact they've had on older and younger generations. Like, that's what I really liked about this.
Yeah. It shows the sort of intricacies of it. That, like the two old women who said, oh yeah, we know Jarvis Cocker. He used to work at the fish market.
Yes.
And then you've got the new generation who are like, oh, I know this because like my parents played it for me. I know this song. And there is so much music. And I've always complained about this to you and Carson and Jakob. There's so much film and music and books and music. There's too much of it. We are never, ever going to be able to listen to it all, look at it all, read it. Nothing. To aspire to that is bloody meaningless. But it's people like us and just everybody else that is sort of the security for good art, essentially. Where we're stood on the gates, waggling our fingers at stuff like Doctor Strange 2.
Yeah.
And we're like pulling apart the red velvet rope for like the unbearable weight of massive talent. And it's rather telling that Pulp's music's lasted that long, where it's been passed down from generation to generation, almost as a piece of great culture. Yeah. It's like, I was going to say like the Beatles, but you cannot compare anyone or anything to the Beatles because you will be shot. So yes. I'm not going to say that. But it's that extent of, this is being passed down generation to generation. Mm-hmm. It's had a similar effect on people. It has touched them emotionally. It's touched them to the point where they want to preserve it to every extent that they can. And you really get the feeling of that in the documentary. However, the documentary is like fine. It's okay. Yes. I'm not really sure what it wants to be. I have no idea what it wants to do. You went to this documentary. Did you read the book first or did you watch the documentary?
Read it first.
So
read the book first and then, yeah.
You read the book and hopped onto the documentary.
Yeah.
Do you feel you've learned more about Pulp or the people of Sheffield?
The people, kind of.
Yeah.
Even though they're a bit of a stereotype, but, you know, that's just how life is. That's always something that I liked in general, because, you know, many complain about, you know, stereotypes and putting labels on people. But it's like, well, but if you actually live the places for real, that's just how it is sometimes.
Yeah. The atmosphere and the people are that. I mean, I lived in Sunderland for about 2 and a bit years.
Yeah.
Big up the Sunderland Town Massive. And every day being there reminds me, just looking back on it and my experience there as a uni student, it always reminds me, do you remember the first time? The lyrics of that song, which is quite just, I don't know, there's no other word for it other than degenerate. It's just such a seedy song. It's probably my favourite of Pulp's, where it's, now I don't care what you're doing, no, I don't care if you scream, just as long as you save a piece for me. It's like, that was, 2 years of that, it was just grim.
It's rough, yep. Yeah.
But it's the actual, like, sort of seedy counterpart to that is that Sunderland kind of was like that. It just kind of was a bit grim and a bit dingy and a bit horrible. I saw someone rob a Poundland, like,
oh no,
of
why?
Burgers. Not of money, but of Russell's Burgers. And I'm always going to associate Pulp with Sunderland because I lived there when I discovered them. I lived there when I bought their albums. I lived there when I listened to it constantly. My flatmates, I know are sick of me. My former flatmates, I still speak to one of them. And I can't go a day without hearing of, like, you know, please stop playing Pulp. Please stop putting it on the record player. Because I would wake up at 6 p.m. I remember that it was January 2018. I would wake up at 6 p.m. I would get ready to go on a night out. I would put a Pulp record on and I would blast it. I would blast it as loud as it would go. And then I would go to the club where they'd play a bit of Pulp. And then I'd go home and I'd get back at about 4:30 in the morning. And I'd listen to a bit more Pulp and then I'd go to bed. And that was my life for a month, which isn't healthy.
It's a pulpy life.
It's a pulpy life, exactly. It's like James Stewart wishes. But to bring it back to Sheffield, it does feel like the director, whose name I cannot pronounce, War Florian.
Florian, yeah. Just
Florian. Yeah, Mr. Florian. It feels like he's trying to connect the dots as in Pulp's from Sheffield, and therefore Sheffield is a shrine to Pulp. And it just feels a bit wrong. It rubs me up the wrong way sometimes, where it's like he's trying to define a lot of people, and rightly so, a lot of people have been defined by their music from that area. It's quite a musically rich place, like Arctic Monkeys, Depeche Mode. And not Depeche Mode, sorry, the Human League. I don't know why I get those two confused.
Same thing.
All 80s music's the same. But people like Richard Hawley have come from Sheffield and written incredible songs. I just think it's a bit strange for the angle to be, let's go and talk to Sheffield people, find all the ones that know of Pulp and have had an impact from them, and just get them to essentially pad out the documentary. And then everything else is just fans outside of stadiums, then surprisingly little time with the band itself.
I want to say it's less than half of the runtime. Removing all of the concert scenes with them, but like if you just take the proper like just documentary sequences, I want to say it's less than half with them. I wonder why.
Yeah.
Have you seen anything else from this director?
No. Watching A Life, Death and Supermarkets kind of put me off.
That's more than enough.
I know he's done a couple of other things, but
he has a bit of a filmography. But what surprised me looking at him, I was like, he's born in Germany, and he moved to New Zealand.
Oh,
and so he's primarily from New Zealand, which is fascinating. And then he also moved to the United States around, like, the late 2000s.
So he moved everywhere Pulp wasn't relevant at the time.
Pretty much, which is kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah.
Because I remember when I was contacted to make a shorter documentary following one guy, it's like an expert of a comic book artist that was born in Venice, and I was barely familiar with him, but like not enough to consider myself someone who knows about the characters that he's created. And the man, like, he contacted me and he was like, you're perfect because you're completely ignorant about this thing. That's what I want. I want someone who's outside of it to show me a different perspective than my own, that's like fully immersed and knee deep into like this writer. And I was watching this and I appreciate the Sheffield side of things more, because it is kind of an outsider's point of view, just trying to peer in through the power of Pulp and the history that they've left in the place. But then you never really get to know Pulp. And I'm also wondering, how did he get the gig? Why did they hire him? Maybe they like one of his movies. I know this love story has been thrown around a bunch when I was looking up this film. I don't know what it is like.
I get where you're coming from, where it's kind of like the outsider influence would be fantastic as an angle. It's a really big gamble. And it just feels like he's looking through a bit of a blurry lens for a lot of it, where it's he's using Pulp as essentially a mouthpiece to talk about Sheffield, but is only talking about Sheffield on the basis that it's about Pulp. And what you get is, I mean, as a documentarian, the documentarian should ask questions that open a dialogue. And he's asking such weird questions of everyone. Like, there's a scene where he interviews the drummer of Pulp, Nick Banks, and it's framed really nicely. You've got a red door behind him, a sign to the left. It looks like a Wes Anderson shot. And he asks nothing of any interest. But then when he does ask something of interest, like he talks about Canada Doll's arthritis, which she's never spoken about until that point, I don't believe. And it's very touching to hear about it, or at least it would have been if there were detail to it, the impact of that on her career, the sort of the exploration of that isn't there. It's just stated as a matter of fact and move on to the next segment about, like, there's a lot of dance routines and karaoke sessions of, like, elderly people singing Help the Aged, or, like, dance routines to Common People, and then intercut with Jarvis Cocker performing Common People, and then it's just an explosion of having too much going on.
Or having too much Common People, but it's like, yes, we get it. We know the song, it opens with it, you listen to it like four more times, and then it's the encore at the end. I was like, stop.
It's, yeah.
Please, I know the lyrics, I love them, now. I get it, okay? Let's please sing something else.
It feels extremely light on the earlier and later periods. They've essentially gone for the popular chunk, but then also tried to bring in a couple songs that are relevant, like Sheffield Sex City, which is like an 8.5 minute track about Sheffield, which is it sounds a lot better than it does.
You know, they're playing to the right crowd.
Exactly that. Yeah,
it's going to play well there.
Sheffield Sex City's got some great lines in it that are very specific to the Sheffield area, but even then, it's just stuff that really speaks for the people of Sheffield and sort of working class Britain as a whole at the time, which was I didn't want to go in the first place, but I've been sentenced to 3 years in the housing benefit waiting room. I must have lost your number in the all-night garage, and now I'm wandering up and down your street calling your name. And it's that link between very lustful romance, or the lack of it, and working class inspirations that have really channeled Pulp for the earlier and then popular period. That much we can explore, but the documentary really doesn't. It's very much a look, everybody, here's like the last hurrah for a band from the area, but no details about what led up to it.
Question: would you prefer this as either a straightforward documentary that's just that, or a straightforward concert film that's literally just the final concert?
I would have preferred a concert film. Mm-hmm. And do you know why? Because he recorded the entire concert, and there was promises of, oh, we'll release the concert film. To this day, nothing. There is audio for the whole concert on YouTube.
Is it like illegally uploaded by someone in the crowd? Oh, no.
I couldn't possibly say it, but yes. It's really frustrating because it has the potential to be one of those great performances that would do a lot for the fans, but it's not exactly Stop Making Sense. You know, it's not exactly an MTV Unplugged performance, but it has those nice little touches, like when they're throwing toilet paper into the crowd. They would do that at early shows to give streamer effect. And it's just little touches like that I'm sure major fans would appreciate. And it's kind of, Life, Death and Supermarkets is one of those features that major fans are going to have to latch onto. But even then, I've watched it about three times now. And my interest in it has dwindled and dwindled and dwindled. It's kind of gotten worse as it's gone on, because you're left really wanting more information, but all you're getting is snippets of a concert film that will never get released, interviews with people that have really no relevance to the impact of the band, and then the occasional cutaway of Jarvis Cocker testing a microphone. And it's finding the balance. I think the best scene in the film is when they're behind the stage and he's going through his sort of drugs cabinet of just, if you've got a headache, we've got this. If you've got a bad throat, we've got this. And it goes on for too long, but it's like the most natural you ever get to see the front man in the film, because the rest of it is kind of playing up to the camera or trying to articulate really nonsense questions.
Yeah, there is always this distance between the filmmaker and the band, which is not present with the people of Sheffield, which is even a bit disappointing, especially as I'm not a... That's like, you asked it, you asked this a bit earlier. But it's just, I left this knowing less about the band than I did going in. Outside of some of their personal problems, like the arthritis of the pianist, but like everything else, like I felt I discovered more about Jarvis reading the lyrics book than I did watching him actually on screen.
Exactly.
Probably should have been more, I don't know, even more amateurish, because even the way this is made, it was kind of bothering me, because it's, you said unfocused. It's unfocused not just in the structure and narrative, but also in the way it's put together, because you have like this like handheld but just not in a good way shots here and there. Then you have very static talking heads moments. You have sequences, you mentioned like the elderly people singing, common people, I think, with the guitar. That's almost like a Bellatar shot, just very static wise. Like, okay, we're doing this now. Like, it keeps changing styles, but never in a way that feels intentional. And I guess I'll just put the camera here on the counter in this scene. I guess I'll just, you know, take some shots of people walking by and just kind of like, we have to get this, we have to move on the side. It was bothering me to the point that I either make something incredibly professional and polished, or make something that's more like a home video, you know, like go deep into people's lives.
I could not have put it better myself. It feels as if there is a new director for every scene and none of them have been given the brief of what they're doing. They're just
what did the other guy do? I don't know. I haven't seen the dailies.
All right, lads, listen, there's a band from Sheffield. We want you to go to Sheffield and record a bit of it. Is that
like
all?
Yeah, people. Sure. What's a pulp? Who's a Jarvis Cocker?
There are times in that documentary where I do wonder how much he actually knows about pulp. Because, and I know what's... there's a book called Freak Out the Squares from the violinist of pulp, who's not in this documentary, Russell Senior. And he was a big part of pulp's sensual sort of rise to the top. He was the guy that streamlined their work. He was the guy that came on when they released their second album, Freaks, I think was their second album. And he essentially careered them to something more marketable. And to not even mention his name, like it's some forbidden text. And it's like, no, they get on just fine. It's just Habich doesn't realize that. He doesn't mention it because he doesn't think it's relevant to what he's trying to portray, which I don't think he himself knows what he's trying to portray. I think it's just such a scattershot reading. I think he's both as excited to be a part of it as he is confused about what to highlight. And he gets close. He gets so close because there's the lecture about the guy saying, why is it that a gangly guy from Sheffield can write so good about sex? And it's, if you just focus in a little more, if you just frame the camera a bit better, put a backdrop on, put a few lyrics on the screen, you've got it. And that's it. That's all you've got to do. But he just sort of weaves in and out of like, oh, this is how this group of people has been touched by Jarvis Cocker's music. This is how these people enjoy Nick Banks. And it's such a cacophony. It's not quite an echo chamber of people love pulp, but it gets to that point where it's, all right, we get it. People like pulp. People are obsessed with Jarvis Cocker. They see him as a strange sex symbol, and they still do.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to add, where's the sustenance? Where's the substance to that line of argument? It's all well and good saying people found him oddly charming. Where's the history behind it? You've got to add the reasoning and the details, because the details are there. They're in like NME in the 90s, and like exploring that is simple. I could do a better job, and I don't know how to work a camera.
There's one moment that stuck with me with Jarvis. I want to say it's towards the end, when Florin is interviewing him, and he kind of asks, like, "How are you performing now?" Like, we're talking about performance. Like, are you performing now? It's like, well, I'm, you know, in front of the camera, of course, I'm performing, something like that. And it's like you said, it's just kind of like, "Oh, that's an interesting question."
Yeah.
But it never goes beyond just that. So we're just stuck in the middle of like, well, that's a good point. We're never going to get
really
more out of it, though.
It's like when he asks him what goes on in your mind on stage. And he's like, nothing. It's like, nothing goes on in my mind. It's like, expand on that. Give us the details. Like, I've no doubt that he's managed to get like the details, but just to cut it down to like, what is essentially a clip show reel? In the format of like those best of the 80s shows they used to show on like Channel 4 and stuff. Like, here's a rundown of the top 50 highlights from the 1990s. Number 3, Gaz's goal against Scotland in Euro 96. And then like number 2 is like Common People. And it's like, it just feels like that. There's no momentum behind it. There's no reason to get involved with the band. And it's just other documentaries about musicians have no problem doing that. I think of the Bob Dylan one. The Criterion Collection released it. I think it's called Don't Look Back. I want to double check. I would
Which
find
is not
me on the shelf.
Martin Scorsese, right? That's not the one.
Yeah, so No Direction Home's the Scorsese one. Don't Look Back is the 67, I believe. And the 67 one is literally exactly what Life, Death, and Supermarkets is doing. It's following the band around. It's following the artist as they just go about their day-to-day lives. It's showcasing the impact that they're having on people, but by showing them having that impact on people, they're there next to people. They're there explaining their reasoning and their personality and their music to people at the time. Bob Dylan does it best. There's a lengthy clip of him and a journalist having a back and forth, like a discussion leading into an argument about music. And it's show that impact, show what people think of Pulp, but have them there. Don't have them as like little pieces that have got to be pulled into every now and then for a quick clip show reel. It's like, it's as if he's trying to fish for like that little slogan to put on the poster. He's trying to fish for that little line that's going to sell the film. And he's not looking at the bigger picture where it's, you can paint something really extraordinary as a documentary filmmaker. You've been given unprecedented access. And it's why I've got a lot of appreciation for people like Louis Theroux or John Ronson. They know what to ask, when to ask it, and why. And it feels like Habich is kind of, he's got all three, but not all at once. He knows what to ask because he's been asked to do it by the band. He knows why to ask it because it's going to lead to a certain scene. And he knows where to ask it and when, because it's their final concert. It's like it's all teed up for him. It's ready to be hit, and he just misses. And it is frustrating because this is essentially the only documentary on Pulp's reunion. There's another one called something like No Sleep Till Sheffield or something like that, which is fine. It's like late night BBC 4 fodder. There's not an immediate documentary that can look at the lyrics. The closest you've got, ironically, is a lyric book from Cocker himself.
The actual thing, and that's it.
Like, nobody is. I'm going to ask you a big question. So you've read the lyrics. Do you think? I mean, I think of great lyricists. Like, it all comes down to personal opinion, but to a degree, it comes down to an appreciation of music as sort of a historic form of art. When I think like great musicians, I think like Joni Mitchell or Leonard Cohen, Nick Cave. But I do think Jarvis Cocker as well. And I was wondering if you thought that, because I've had this conversation with several friends and they've all said, stop huffing paint, essentially. Please stop talking out of your ass, you madman.
It's like you've kidnapped them and just forced them to listen to this.
I remember at uni, I had brought a speaker and I was the only one that had a speaker. And it was one of those where you could plug an iPod into it. So because it's my speaker... I plugged my iPod into it, and the only albums I had on it were the Mamma Mia soundtrack from the first movie, and
this is going to make Carson happy.
A compilation of late 80s Pulp songs, so like before Babies released, so it's stuff like My Lighthouse and like Little Curve of Blue Eyes, and I think Oh You Gone Gone was on there as well, which is like the real dregs of their early work, which is still great songs, but
it's very fun.
It's very fun, but would you say he's one of the great lyricists? Is he up there with Bob Dylan and John Lennon and Patti Smith?
I'm a heathen when it comes to those things. I'm not nearly as knowledged in music as you are.
I'm not knowledged. I just talk lots, and then somehow I've managed to get where I am today.
You deceive people.
It's really easy.
But you know, I don't know. I'll say that there's definitely a lot here that had me thinking about multiple things. Just, it's not banal. It's actually really, like, reading the lyrics before listening to most of these songs improved the experience as well.
Yeah.
I honestly, I'd say, like, yes. Yes. I'd say it fits in that category.
There we go.
If we're keeping it very broad, it fits. Yeah. If it's like a pantheon of just 10 people allowed, then maybe not. But, you know, it still does what lyrics should be. Like, if you're not focusing on them, they flow by very nicely. But if you're actually honing in your attention and focus on just figuring out what he's talking about, it's enlightening on himself, on the people that he met, on society and just culture at the time. It's the full package in that sense.
Yeah, and it's that full package I think is harder to capture, especially now with pop music and sort of the way it's running. I mean, in his book, like not this one, the new one he's just released at the time, Good Pop, Bad Pop, he wrote that he was actively trying to be a pop artist. He was never under the impression that he was this sort of grand lyricist that was going to change the world of music. He wanted to be a star of pop.
Hmm.
And it's difficult to do that when your lyrics are better than most pop music. Like, if you think of pop music now, like Ed Sheeran, that, hang on, I'm trying to think of actual pop art.
Just Ed Sheeran.
Cardi B, I think, is one.
Billie Eilish.
Billie Eilish, yes, that's a pop artist.
It shows how little I know about music. It's like the most famous singers that people know.
If you look at like the chart, like Adele, for instance, Adele is always praised for having these beautiful lyrics. Meh, no, not really, though, is it? Because you look at something, and again, Leonard Cohen always springs to mind, but people like, I'm going to get, like, no, I won't say Bono. Bono's a strange lad. But people like Leonard Cohen, people like Nick Cave, there's such beauty to the lyrics. Like you said, it's that perfect blend between, if you're not paying attention to the lyrics, don't worry about it. There's some beautiful instrumentals in there. But if you are listening to the lyrics, it's this whole new level. It's a whole new layer that surpasses what others have tried to do. You know, I don't know what Ed Sheeran tries to sing about, but I imagine he does it poorly.
Like, a lot of love.
Yeah, exactly. So if we're to take Ed Sheeran and we're comparing him to Jarvis Cocker, they've got different stances on love. And they've got different ways of singing about it, but there is clearly one that is stronger than the other.
There's also one that's more marketable than the other.
Exactly.
You know, that's why everyone in the world knows Ed Sheeran, and he can be in Game of Thrones.
Oh yeah, he was,
like a Danny Boyle movie and whatnot.
Yeah, but he wasn't in Life, Death, and Supermarkets, was he?
Nope. He wishes he was.
It's kind of weird as to where we are with just music in general, where I still feel that documentaries about music are kind of dwindling, like in quality as well as quantity. There's one coming about Leonard Cohen, but that's just on one song. It's on his version of Hallelujah, and that's it.
I feel really bad. Like when I went to, we talked about this briefly off mic one time, but when I went to last year's Venice Film Festival, there were quite a few documentaries on music in general. There was a band. What was the band? I saw the lead singer. That's how little I know about music. I remember I was like there, and they were like, "Oh, it's the band guy." I was like, "Oh, cool!" And just, it's not Pink Floyd, because I know Pink Floyd. I've seen Roger Waters live at Venice. Dang it, which was fun. I don't even remember. I'll look him up 1 second. But like, it's one of those things. Like, I was very chill, and then like I got flooded in my comments on Instagram. People are like, "Oh my god, did you saw that guy?" Like, I guess, you know, it was just there. I just took a picture. Oh, Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin. Oh,
right, okay.
That's a small band.
Pretty,
you know,
big. You know, Led Zeppelin, responsible for 5 excellent albums.
It took me so long to get there. That just says everything about me. But you're right, though. No, I agree. Yeah. There's very, very few documentaries, but so, like proper documentaries, because we do get a lot of those concert films. Fine, they're enjoyable, I guess. Like, it's not the same as going to the actual concert, but it's better than not having it.
Yeah, and I think even now it's like, considering the documentary boom, you know, like Netflix is powering through miniseries after miniseries. Like, I'm pretty sure one just came on about Andy Warhol, and then a day later there was one about, like, a cult of religious figures, and it's like, there's so many documentaries about so many niche subjects that people are finding interesting because it's like, oh, grand, something to just kind of watch after work, just to unwind. And there is no better, like, topic for unwinding than listening to good music and just learning a bit about it. But it's kind of odd to me that the only documentaries on music I think about are... There's an Amy Winehouse one.
Amy's very good.
There's Supersonic, which is about Oasis, which is kind of like making a documentary about garbage. And there's...
Miss Americana by Tay.
Miss Americana, yes. There's the 5'2" by Lady Gaga. And Stop Making Sense. And there's lots of Bob Dylan ones. But then that's the like sort of layer at the top. Underneath that, it's just a lot of made for TV stuff that's kind of like being forgotten about. You can watch it once when it's shown like NBC at 2 a.m, catch it up for 30 days, and then it's gone. And it's I still don't understand why documentaries on musicians haven't quite captured that mainstream love that documentaries are seeing now.
I don't know. I think it's because it's probably too niche per se, and it's very like, if I were to sit down and I was asked to like make a documentary about a band, I don't even care which band, but just a band.
Led Zeppelin.
My first, like Led Zeppelin, my favorite band. I was made to a documentary on Duran Duran. I love Duran Duran. I know their songs.
Duran Duran is fantastic.
Well, good taste. You know, there's even a beautiful, if you haven't seen it, even to listeners, there's a beautiful concert film by my man David Lynch of Duran Duran. It's so good. It's so fun. Anyway, it's David Duran Duran unstaged. Oh man, just watch it. Fantastic. Watch it. It's streaming on Prime here in Italy, apparently, so you know. But if I were to make a documentary, my first question would be, outside of like, what are we going to talk about? Is this going to be for fans, or is this going to be for just at the most general audience possible, which includes people who don't know about Duran Duran? Because like what you were talking, I remembered I saw last year, the year before, the Spike Jonze Beastie Boys documentary,
which
is again kind of a documentary, but it's more like their masterclass / concert just
precisely
recorded
yeah.
live. But still, like, I don't know about Beastie Boys. I left that one knowing a bit more about them because it's more chronological and told by them.
It was like a TED Talk where David Cross showed up for a bit.
Yes, that was fun. I liked
it. Yeah, I loved it. I really enjoyed it. I think it was like, it was nice to get such a good film out early doors for 2020.
Yes. The other one I absolutely loved, Summer of Soul, that was in my top 20 last year. Yeah. And that one is exactly what you were talking about.
Yeah.
You have the good music if you want to have the good music, and you have a bit of information if you actually want to like sit down and listen to what they're talking about. It's like you're actually going to learn something. But I agree, there's not much else about music. And it was, I actually just Googled like best music documentary. So I was like, I need a list. I just need to look at the list to have a general idea if I've seen many of those. And I've seen most of the ones that we've mentioned, and then the rest are just concert films.
Exactly. It's going to be stuff like Pink Floyd's The Wall. It's going to be the concert tour they did.
Yeah.
It's going to be stuff like The Beatles Get Back, I think, is the most recent example. But please tell me, an average fan that is going to sit and watch 8.5 hours of the Beatles recording sessions. Because even me and my friend, who are like really big Beatles fans, we struggled through bits of that.
I love Beatles, but I'm not watching
it's so
that now.
Long.
Who cares? No. Like, make it 3 hours. That's like 8 hours.
It's Peter Jackson. He works in trilogies. It's got to be 3 episodes. But
it
even then, it's like,
me.
The other side of that spectrum is the Oasis Nebworth 96, which I reviewed for Clapper. Go and check that one out. That is, and the issue there is that it's got the details that you need, but it's done in a way that makes it impossible to approach with any sincerity. It's a fictionalized account of random people exploring their memories of Nebworth. And a good 20 minutes is, and then I was on the phone waiting to buy concert tickets, and then I didn't buy concert tickets. And it's like, thanks for that. Brilliant. I kind of want to know about the lead up for the band, not the fans. It's
Did Florian direct this one as well?
I'm afraid not. I think, just considering like the amount of documentaries, like, I mean, there was the Bob Ross documentary, there's Francesco Totti documentary, the Paw Patrol movies probably is a documentary at this point. There's so many, but why? I mean, I kind of get it. It's like you said, a lot of bands are quite niche.
I honestly think it's because like if you don't know them, you're not going to watch them. I was like, many people love the Olivia Rodrigo documentary that came out. I don't know a single song by Olivia Rodrigo.
That's the thing.
Why should I watch the documentary?
But movies and documentaries of form, it's like, I found out who Talking Heads were through Stop Making Sense. I remember Silent Dawn on Letterboxd, big man himself. had it in his favorites for that long, and I clicked on it. I was like, what is this? What is this big suit? I thought it was a horror film. Genuinely, like, I saw the big suit, I saw dark colors and red, right? I thought, oh, stop making sense. It's written into someone's blood, I imagine.
Is he holding a gun?
And it was like, whoa, it's a concert film. I've heard of these guys before. My mum likes Once in a Lifetime.
Hey.
It's like, right, I'll watch it. And then that's one of my favorite films of all time now. And it's...
I really love the Spike Lee one as well, just to...
Oh, yes. Fantastic. The American Utopia.
American Utopia.
Incredible.
Oh, I've listened to that album just...
Oh, it's fantastic.
Sorry.
No, I'm happy to talk about David Byrne for an hour.
Get a shout about him.
I watch documentaries quite a lot of the time to learn about something new. Okay. I remember watching stuff like, you know, it helps if you've got a bit of an interest in them, like the Beatles one or the Bob Ross one. But then I remember the very first article I wrote for Clapper, Jack sent me a screener for a documentary called Mirror Moglu, The Robinson of Manhattan Island. Not a clue what it was about. I still don't know what it's about, but I learned something from it. And I think that's what good documentaries do. You learn something from them, even if you don't know what it's about. Like, from the past few years, I can think Class Action Park, Zappa, Pretend It's a City, the Sparks documentary from Edgar Wright.
Yes! How did we get this far without
how did we get that far?
That's a good one.
In a similar vein to that, there was two that came out as well. The Velvet Underground self-titled documentary and McCartney 321.
I need to watch that. I love Velvet Underground.
There's such a broad expanse of documentary filmmaking that's kind of like, it's going to teach you something. You're going to learn and you're going to experience something new. And that's such an important avenue of learning, especially now when we live in a culture where I cannot be bothered to pick up that book on Stalingrad that's rested on my shelf for 3 years. I'd rather watch like a snippet of it to see if I'll be interested in it. And I think that's where Netflix have captured the market so well, is that episodics, like their hour-long things, four episodes an hour long. Oh, well, the first episode's finished. It was like a nice hook. May as well finish it because you've got nothing else to do that evening. And I think it all comes down... I think I've just got a very active mind where it's like, I've got to learn about more things. I've got to go and experience new things. And it's like, sat listening to like the Taylor Swift documentary or... like the last blockbuster. And it's, if documentaries, the sole purpose of them is to give someone that knows nothing of the subject an experience that they will either remember or learn from, then Life, Death and Supermarkets fails just fundamentally. It does not have what it takes to teach you anything. It doesn't have what it takes to draw you in beyond look at the flashy colours and look what it means to people at Sheffield. That's the baseline, that's it.
Yeah,
and it's why Mother Brother Love is probably like the only in currently of this is Pulp music. This is what they did, and it's, I don't know. It's just so frustrating because it's such an untapped market, and I don't know how to work cameras, so it's a no from me.
Yeah, this is one of those rare instances where I kind of like the movie less after talking about it.
Yeah. It's just every time it's brought up, it just goes down in my estimation. It's like, oh
yeah, because we brought up so many better documentaries.
Nick Cave has three better documentaries: 20,000 Days on Earth,
One
More Time with Feeling, Idiot Prayer, and he's got that fourth one out as well.
This Much I Know Is True, yeah, which I missed. Yeah, that's it. Was like two days in the cinemas. It was literally that was out.
One day, 40 miles away, and it's like, I can make that. It's like, no, it's got work tomorrow.
It's, yeah. But I think it's coming on digital soon enough, which is not the same as watching it on the big screen. But, you know, I'm very looking forward to that one by Andrew Dominik. But again, I think that's the problem with Pulp, Life and Death, and Supermarkets. It's alienating. And the worst part is, you're a fan. And you still were disappointed. So it's even like, well, but it's an inner circle kind of thing. If you're in it, you appreciate it more. It's like, no. It's distanced to a fault. I know there is an interview. If I remember, I'll try putting it in the links of this episode. On Issue Magazine, you can look it up if you want, listeners. where the director Florian was interviewed about the making of the film, and he goes into like, why did you make this documentary? How much did Jarvis like chime in on the making of it? Whose idea was it to just, you know, talk about Sheffield as well as the band? So if you want answers, they're there. I was skimming through it, and it's like, it's very, you know, sensible answers. It's like, guess it's fine, but like nothing stood out to me, which is a shame. That's how it is, you know, that's how it is, unfortunately.
It is unfortunate, but at the very least, we do have the lyric book to rely on.
We do have the lyric book, which is infinitely, like, it. I finished it saying, oh my god, I feel like I know Jarvis Cocker, and then I looked at the documentary and felt like I was looking at someone else.
Yeah.
And when we look at it, it's like 10% of the runtime.
It's the, there's a quote on the back from Frank Cottrell Boyce from his piece Caught by the River, and he says, Cocker is alert to the poetry of the shopping aisle, the school playground, and the TV schedule. Jarvis Cocker's lyrics are just as good as proper poetry. I think they should be studied in schools and carved on gravestones. And considering, yes, when I was at school, the only poetry I studied was Carol Ann Duffy, I can safely assure you I would have much preferred to study a song that opens with the lines, I'm back in full effect, can't even hold myself erect, which is a beautiful pastiche that mocks his own music. But that does bring
those are rhymes, man, right there.
Spitting bars for days, as they say. It does bring me to my last question. How much of Pulp and Jarvis Cocker did you listen to? Like, did you listen to the albums? Did you listen to the songs?
I went absolutely insane fighting my Spotify because I kept telling I just want to listen to Jarvis Cocker Shuffle. Just give me music. I don't care. And every two songs, it would just change artist and band. And then he kept doing that. I was like, this doesn't sound like him anymore. And then check. I was like, fuck. So I managed to listen. I want to say I listened to around 15 of the songs. Most of which are actually in this book.
Yeah.
And also in the documentary, of course, they're played. It's like five or six songs, though, that are played in the documentary.
Yeah,
like, it's not that many, even. I don't remember the name because there was no way of checking it in the actual documentary. But I want to say my favorite one in terms of performance was the final one before the encore.
That'll be Common People, actually.
Before it.
Oh,
because he sings a whole song where they're like swaying the hands, and then he goes into Common People after.
Bar Italia.
Wow, there you go.
Yeah. Bar Italia is such a lovely song.
That was very moving.
Yeah,
which is not in the lyrics book.
Yes. There's a lot of omissions in the lyrics book, and I suppose the only criticism I've got of the lyrics book is that there are so many good lyrics that he managed to crack out.
It should be an omnibus. There's so much good stuff.
170 doesn't feel like enough pages for the amount he's got. There's no... There's a lot missing. Like, a lot of the slept-on songs, there's no Monday Morning. There's no... There's a lot missing. This is a highlight book. This is like the highlight reel. There's not going to be like... I mean,
what a highlight.
It can't be a highlight reel. It's got like B-sides that never got released.
It's so bizarre. I love it.
It's fascinatingly good. But what was your favourite song? Was it Bar Italia?
In the documentary, yes.
Yeah.
I really vibed with This Is Hardcore.
Yes, I'm so glad.
So much, especially when you sent me the new version, like the extended, like 8-minute remix.
Yeah, the start of that track is actually the last song on the extended version of the record. It's called End of the Line. And I've written it down, I did a bit of research on this. It's inspired by Peter Thomas Sound Orchestra's Bolero on the Moon Rocks. And the imagery associated with it, which is kind of, if you've seen the music video, essentially LA noir aesthetics. It's like late 40s of movie making. Like it is the essential noir Humphrey Bogart era is what they were trying to depict. And it's, that'll always stick with me. And I think it's why I like the song so much. And it's just phenomenal.
It is a very fun, like the music videos are very fun.
Yeah.
I watched the one, which one was it? I'm looking up. a little girl with blue eyes, one of those party fun. Babies as well. But like, yeah, you know, it's different times as well of music making.
Yeah, exactly that. It's,
what's your favorite song, Ewan?
Oh, there's so many memories I've got associated with a lot of these songs, both good and bad. You know, I mean, like Disco 2000, for instance, I would always request that at the nightclub. And for 2 years, I would listen to that every Friday, completely out of my mind, drinking. And it was just nice. It's one of the few songs I actually feel I can dance to. I went out, as you know, Nick, I went out instead of doing the Disaster Artist recording. And I remember we went to a nightclub, and it's the first time I've been in a nightclub in years, and I just felt frigid. I just couldn't move, and it wasn't because I'm embarrassed of my absolute mental dance move skills. It was because the music did nothing for me, and I can't throw my arms around to a beat I'm not interested in. And I think Disco 2000 was kind of that for me. It was the highlight of any night. But I think because I've been listening to it recently, probably This Is Hardcore. The lyrics on it are some of the best I've ever heard. It was leave your makeup on, now leave on the light, come over here babe and talk in the mic, oh yeah, I hear you now, it's gonna be one hell of a night. And then the crescendo of the piano and just that bit that leads into the first This Is Hardcore vocal verse, utterly just phenomenal. I've got it on vinyl. I blast it every now and then as I get over the road. Every Saturday wakes me up with an air horn because he's like seven.
Oh,
but it's
geez.
Like so early in the morning that he just starts like honking a clown horn and blasting an air horn. It's like running around the garden. It's like the only way to combat noise is more noise. So I'm currently on This Is Hardcore.
Just
and
blasting him with music.
Blasting with some good music. Maybe he'll calm down.
You remember that in his adulthood?
I would hope so. But even then, it's kind of like some of my favorites. I've got such horrible memories. I don't know if it's in the book, Something Changed. I've just got such disastrous memories associated with that song, but it's one of my favorites. Something Changed is in. I wrote this song 2 hours before we met. I didn't know your name or what you looked like yet. It's like, that's such a good two lines there. And it's like, it's the only song I can half-heartedly play on the guitar.
Oh.
And that's not—it's not just because I'm terrible at the guitar, but my wrists are just broken beyond repair, and I can't actually.
You write 200 articles a day. This is what happens.
People listening can't see. I've just done that, like the strumming, and that hurts to do. So it's like, I can't do that, but I can do the opening, to the song, and I've always found a lot of comfort in just kind of strumming the first few notes, and it's just really nice.
Hey.
Yeah, it's just thinking about the memories I've got associated with those songs is quite unique. And I think everybody has that artist, you know. They've always got someone that they kind of utilize and reflect on and piece with parts of their life, you know. It's like one of the first bands I ever listened to was the Hoosiers. And the only thing I ever remember about the Hoosiers, and I listened to the album today actually, it's not a very good album. But I remember walking around the city when I was about 8 years old, listening on my mum's iPod to the Hoosiers. And it's one of those moments that just has no significance. It didn't do anything unique. It wasn't like a major event. It was just a nice event. It was comfortable. And a lot of the times when I listen to Pulp, it just brings about a very comfortable feeling. Like I listen to like Jarvis Cocker's new stuff in the gym because some of it's actually quite fast. Am I missing something? And sometimes I'm Pharaoh, which aren't in the lyric book, but fantastic. If you ever get the chance to see him live, I think he does like Milan and stuff like that.
Yeah, let me actually see him.
Gotta go. It's an experience. Especially when he starts shouting at photographers. That was not fun.
But, it seems very, very private. Very private.
He does, yeah. And I think that's the difficulty with making a documentary focused on him. He didn't really want to speak about anything.
The nearest concerts are Paris or Portugal.
Not far.
That's not too far.
That's like, what, a 20-minute drive?
30 minutes.
Ah, well. Cancel the whole trip. Have you got a least favourite song or lyric that you've read in the book?
Not really. Like, that stands out to me. Let me look at the list very briefly.
I'll always stand by not liking the trees. I just think it's such a... It's just so dumb.
Ooh, mine is right after the trees. The weeds to the origin of the species was a bit like... This
yeah.
Was, what's this about?
They're both from the same album.
Well, there you go. It's an environmentally conscious album, I guess.
Yeah, their last album, Bad Cover Version, was produced by Scott Walker. And I don't know why they took this angle of, like, very environmental A-side coupled by some incredible B-side stuff. It was really weird. But yeah, it just doesn't... Yeah. Yeah, the trees. Those useless trees. It's like, oh, come on. This is nothing with flowers from Talking Heads, but
it's
worse.
It's not nuanced. It's not particularly nuanced compared to some of the other songs.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing you can say about his lyrics. There's not much nuance to them. Everybody knows that they're talking about sex, they're talking about relationships and sort of the breakdown of marriage, but it's the wordplay. It's the... I think it's Feeling Called Love, or the one... Oh, what's it called? Yeah, it is Feeling Called Love. It's like just such intimate details about, like, not graphic content, but like very intimate details. It's like the shape of your breasts and the way you, like, the curve of your belly, and I have to sit down and catch my breath, stuff like that.
Mm.
I think that might actually be I Spy. It's a different class nonetheless, but it's like the specifics of sexualization and sort of the lack of embarrassment that Cocker has in singing it makes it so easy to connect with.
Yeah. Amen. Amen to that.
I suppose we know the answer to this question. But I've got to ask, because the contract deems so. Nick, good old buddy, old pal. Which was better, the book or the film?
The book. There's no question. I had a way better time just reading the lyrics and then listening to them rather than watching the documentary, which again has good moments to it, but it's just half-baked.
Precisely, yes. It's half-baked. Yeah, the book is obviously better. I can't even... It doesn't even have the benefit of, like... It doesn't have the benefit of playing the songs either, because the songs are in the book, and reading them is just such a grand and different experience to actually hearing them.
In the concert documentary, there's not enough concert.
That's the thing. It's like, you can't, like, Common People, is such an explosive song at the end. And to, like, castrate that for an hour, it's barbaric. It's actual torture.
Yeah, you hear it already, like, multiple times, including the opening.
Yeah. It's one of the only topics where I've thought, if I could make films, I could make a better documentary on it. I definitely could, but I can't do that. I don't know how to edit things. Neither does Florian, though.
I could help out in that way.
Fantastic. Let's really take it to him.
Drop an email to Jarvis.
Hey up, Jarv lad. We're making another documentary. We'll do it like that pulp one you did earlier, but worse.
Which for yet another reunion.
They'll have to do another reunion. But yeah, I think we're both fairly in agreement then. That the book is far superior, even if, you know, for people that want to learn about pulp, read the book, but then...
Mm.
The document, what is the, I don't even want to think about what
just read the Wikipedia pages and
read
look
the Wikipedia
videos.
Page and then just
watch the music videos and that's it. You get more out of it.
You do, yeah. And it's not as if there aren't concert films for Pulp. There's three, so they're just not very well watched. I think that about wraps it up, though. I think we're all pulped out now. We're freshly squeezed like a mighty orange. I think
pretty
they've
much.
Got pulp, haven't they? It's oranges that have... Yeah, it's pulp shoot. Yeah. Pulp Fiction, pulpy orange. Yeah. Because the band's named after the Michael Caine film from 72. Pulp. By, I believe it's Mike Hodges, where Michael Caine plays a CD travel pulp writer. It's phenomenal. Arrow did a very, very nice touch-up of it. But that is the inspiration behind Pulp. I'm glad I left that to the very end.
I'll have to watch it because it sounds very interesting.
That honestly, I don't know, Jakob will be listening, I hope. That is an uncut gem. That's not like a postal, haha, that's an uncut gem. Pulp is a genuine uncut gem that's like very good.
It's a proper one.
It's an actual film that we can watch.
Well, same director of Get Carter, so it's going to be a good one.
Michael Caine and the Get Carter director go on a holiday and just make Get Carter again.
Get Carted too.
Get Carted. They did a remake already. Stallone made a fine Get Carter. I still can't believe that happened.
Memories. Anyway.
Nick, I'm finally in a position where I get to ask you this bloody question.
Hey.
Where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter and Instagram at NickyGran97, and there you can find me linktree.com/enjoythemovies with links to my short films and videos and, Letterboxd, Clapper articles, all that good stuff. And also, you can find me every week on the Uncut Gems podcast where with my good buddies, Yuan. Ah, no!
I don't do that. I'm a working man.
I didn't mess up the name of the podcast. So I didn't say Death by Adaptation. But you can find my co-hosts, Yakub Flash and Randy Burrows, where we talk about underrated films, hidden gems, and lovely movies like Postal and House of the Dead with the fine Juan Gledo here.
One of those is a good movie.
One of those is indeed a good movie, but we leave it out to you to find out. When you listen to the episode, to the epic episode.
Somehow that didn't surpass 4 hours long episode.
Jesus Christ.
You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Ewan Gledow, EwanGledow. You may want to slow down the recording to listen to that one again. And you can also find my writing on a number of places, including Cult Following, The Geek Show, Narc Magazine, Clapper Horrorwood, any volume, Spotlight, Newcastle World, Sparks and Lund, Daily Star, Daily Mirror, and I'm sure there'll be a lot more in the future. You can join us next time, though. I'm sure we'll be back for Fight Club. We'll be joined by Uncle Gem's very own Jakob Flash. I say his name right, Jakob Flash.
Yeah,
he's got such a bloody cool name. I'm really annoyed by that. Jakob Flash. That's amazing.
A legend, a king.
I was named after Ewan McGregor.
Well, really?
Yeah, genuinely, yeah.
Oh, wow.
My dad, huge Trainspotting fan. So I was named after a heroin addict from a film that has a Pulp song in it. It's all connected, a big full circle, just to end the episode on right there.
It took 22 years to get to this moment.
It did. My life has been, my whole career, my life, it's just been a connection of waiting for a Trainspotting reference and I can die happy now. That's it for me.
Nice, nice, yeah. Thank you very much for listening. You know, we'll see you in 3 weeks because we're taking a bit of a break. Yes, for the Fight Club episode.
So, we are. I'm going to hibernation.
Summer, finally.
Hibernation, like the bear from Over the Hedge.
Hibernation. Oh no.
Over there. Oh, Uncut Gem. Over the Hedge.
I was going to leave the episode with feeling better about myself and my life, and now I have this bitter aftertaste in my mouth thinking about Over the Edge.
Are you saying a Bruce Willis and Gary Shandling led feature where they respectively play a turtle and a raccoon fighting a big bear is not the note you want to leave this episode on? I think it's the note we should start a new episode with for Uncut Gems.
It's the note we deserve.
We'll get the whole gang together. Me, you, Jack, Carson, everyone. Oh, we'll get everyone in. 7-hour podcast.
Talking about Over the Edge. But yes, thank you very much for listening. We hope to see you soon. And we hope you have a pleasant day. Bye-bye.
Lovely. Bye.